Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and downloading. I am your host, Neil Horwitz. You can follow me on Twitter, NJH287. Hit me up on LinkedIn as well, where I post a little bit. And also, you can find more episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Mixlr, as well as at dsmsports.net. Really psyched for today's show. Goes a little bit of deep dive into all things digital and social video. Obviously, video is continuing to grow. We're heading toward a world of seemingly everything video, at least everything moving. And this guy is on top of all of it. It's his job to be on top of all of it. As our guest today is Brandon Costa. He is the director of digital for Sports Video Group. He'll give a little introduction into what Sports Video Group is, but basically all the thought leaders converge there in the sports video space. So really good conversation coming up with Brandon. But first, this episode's helpful tool. This episode's helpful tool is, well, in the along the theme of the episode, it's about video and video creation when you're on the go, so mobile. This is probably the best video app out there. I mean, Adobe has a good one in itself, but this app today for the helpful tool, it's called LumaFusion, LumaFusion. It is a $19.99 charge, but that one-time charge is well worth it. This is not one I've been that hands-on myself. I want to be upfront with that, but from what I've read about it, what I watched on YouTube with it, it is very user-friendly and probably one of the most powerful mobile apps for video creation I've seen. It's very similar to what you may be accustomed to in Adobe Premiere or Final Cut Pro. There's multiple tracks you can do. You can easily trim selections. You can add transitions with their built-in transitions. You can do color filtering and color correction, rather. You can add in background music from their stock collection. You can also import audio. Just one of the most robust mobile video creation platforms that I've seen. And of course, then you can easily export, save, or share to a social media device. And you know, we're always trying to do something more with video. It's one thing to just shoot some raw video, upload to Instagram stories or Snapchat, and there's still a place for that. But to be able to produce or look to create something that looks like it was produced over hours in front of a big laptop or desktop is pretty powerful, that capability that lives within the LumaFusion app. So give it a go. Download it, start creating some cool videos with everything in the transitions, lower thirds, audio background, and I'll look to be impressed with some of the video coming out there. And LumaFusion is definitely a tool that a social media manager can have in their arsenal. So that's this helpful tool, LumaFusion, a $20 app for iOS or Android. Give it a go today, and we will be right back to talk to Brandon Costa of the Sports Video Group. All right, right back from this episode's helpful tool. I'm really psyched for our guest today, someone I've been following along for a while, or just joking how I feel like I've known him for years. I'm joined today on the podcast by Brandon Costa. He is the director of digital for the Sports Video Group. Welcome to the podcast today, Brandon.
Hey, Neil, thanks a lot for having me on, man. Same thing, like, you know, you follow so many people in the industry and communicate with them via Twitter or whatever it may be, and you feel like you know people, and to finally get a chance to talk to you in person is great. I've been listening to your show for a while, so it's an honor to be a part of it.
I appreciate the kind words, and looking forward to picking your brain a little bit about all things video, which is really cool work that you guys do there at SVG. But before we get into the meat of the discussion, want to hear a little about you. Tell us about your career path, you know, getting started in the game and, you know, getting involved with SVG and any tips for folks that want to do what you do.
Sure. I'm at Sports Video Group, which it can be a little bit difficult to explain at times. I'm pretty sure my parents still have no idea what I do for a living. They just know that I get a paycheck and they don't bother. So we are the Industry Trade Association for people who work behind the scenes in sports television. That's probably the best way to describe it. And when I use the word television, I mean more broadly just video production, where the video is consumed is not necessarily, I won't say not important to us, but we're on the production and the content creation end and a little bit less on the distribution end. I know that's changing now with some of the OTT platforms that are out there. So as director of digital, that means I kind of oversee our digital efforts both from an internal and external basis. So internally, that means, you know, designing the website, running our social media accounts, running our on-demand division, which is all of our video content creation. And then externally, that means our relationships with those professionals that work in the sports video production community. So whether that's someone who is the director of digital media or the CTO at NBC Sports Digital, or someone who maybe works at Bleacher Report or someone who works at Barstool, whatever it may be, we maintain relationships with people throughout the industry. They read our content. They watch our videos. They come to our professional networking events. and digital, whether that's team, league, network, publisher, we engage with those folks on a regular basis to see what some of the common technological challenges are for them, what are some of the common industry pain points, and we bring them all together to talk about them, advance technology, and kind of advance innovation across the board. It's a pretty cool organization to be a part of. It's nothing I ever really kind of thought I could do when I was first coming out of college. I mean, when I was in college, you kind of just think, all right, I'll try to get a job at a network or a newspaper or a website or something like that. So I went to Hofstra University on Long Island.
Go Pride.
I went to the radio station there. Yeah, exactly. WRHU is a killer sports department there. They still do an awesome job. In fact, I believe they still broadcast New York Islanders games, which is pretty awesome for college kids to be doing that. So I went there, worked at the radio station. I wish I could give your listeners like a clearer path to how I got to where I was, but like my degree literally has nothing to do with what I do for a living now. I got my degree in secondary education and history, so I'm supposed to be, you know, a stuffy history teacher right now with elbow pads on my blazer and everything. And that, you know, so that didn't really work out because I was still doing the radio station thing and kind of pursuing the sports broadcasting / content creation stuff on the side. And I got my first job out of college at MLB.com. It was MLB Advanced Media. This is prior to like the MLB Network days, so it was very different kind of ecosystem at the time. And was working game night shifts there, you know, doing highlight packages, voiceovers, edits for things that would pop up on team sites or on MLB.com. So those were really, really fun. I mean, I couldn't ask for a better first job out of college, especially as someone who loved baseball so much as a kid. So, but, you know, the hours were tough. I mean, you're working long game nights. You'd get in at maybe like 6 or 7 o'clock at night, and you would stay until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning or until that extra inning Oakland A's game decides to end. So, like I said, we're a really great first job. I got the opportunity to work in the newspaper industry as well. I worked at a paper called the Asbury Park Press, which is a Gannett-owned paper on the Jersey Shore. And then balanced those kinds of jobs together for a while until the opportunity at SBC opened up. And that was a full-time gig that I didn't really know I was getting myself into, but it's proven to be a pretty awesome place to be.
That's great, and I can definitely appreciate the grind for sure. And I don't think people really realize what a grind it is until you're packing up at 3 a.m. and kind of hoping that someone just walks off already so you can get out and go home already.
Oh my God! Well, yeah, I'm sure anyone who's worked in sports knows that when games go to overtime or extra innings, you start rooting for very weird things, like players you've never heard of. Like, you know, I'm a relatively big Yankees fan, but let me tell you, if the Yankees were in Seattle and it was like the bottom of the 13th inning, I don't care who that number 9 hitter is on the Mariners, but I want him to walk off right now so I can go home.
Oh gosh, definitely it affects your loyalties for sure. So tell me now, you gave a great overview of Sports Video Group, but I want to kind of hear, you know, how you felt like you were well positioned for the job you have now. It's a very unique role. It's someone that has to have their pulse on really everything in the industry, and you kind of are at the center of thought leadership there. So I guess coming up, did you get those skills, especially maybe with MLB.com, probably just as much when you were in college, and start to really wrap your head around the quickly evolving space of video, particularly in sports? And I guess tell me about how the MLB job helped prepare you as well, and kind of where we were at in time. Was there a lot of real-time distribution at that point? Was there a lot of, you know, mobile video at that point? Kind of tell me how it evolved and how it led to your skill set for today.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think having the two jobs that I did simultaneously out of college, one being at MLB.com and the other being at a newspaper, kind of gave me an interesting background in that when I joined the press, this was about, you know, 2007 or 2008. So, you know, not exactly the glory days of newspapers at that point when it was, where the transition was really starting to hit them when I got there. And then on the same night, you know, I'm switching over to MLB.com, which is at the time and still is one of the most forward-thinking, technologically advanced organizations. So I was, on one hand, I was seeing a traditional media brand in a local newspaper struggling with the transition, while MLB.com is literally like kicking butt on a nightly basis trying new and different things. So when I was at MLB.com, this was still, you know, still the days of MLB radio, where they were live streaming kind of radio, sports radio talk shows. So we'd be doing interviews with the local MLB.com beat writers and other athletes across MLB. And we'd be creating video, shooting out highlights. I mean, at the time, pretty much all the highlights, it was kind of the first wave and the first era where you could go online and get highlights either within like the hour or 2 hours of when the hit happened, mm-hmm. Or you can get a full highlight package within a, you know, an hour or two within the completion of the game. So we were still at the point where MLB was a little bit slow to adapt to real-time highlights in a social media environment, mm-hmm. though social wasn't really used for that until the NBA, just, you know, really kind of pushed the envelope there.
Right.
But as far as, you know, having a place where fans could get real-time highlights, it was about as immediate as you could get at the time. So it was very interesting to see how we decided as a team to package content, cut highlights, what we prioritized. So it was a really interesting time to see how digital-first companies, which maybe are not crippled by the traditional business models of long-time legacy businesses, mm-hmm. How they really do genuinely have a leg up sometimes because they're not married to some of the ways that they've always done things. So that helps a lot. And I think that, you know, the Asbury Park Press, to this day, they've definitely figured a lot of things out. They do a lot of things well, so I'm really happy for a lot of people over there. But very definitely got to see a bit of a tough transition for them as they figured things out. And, you know, we're all still trying to figure out how to exactly handle things right on digital. What do we put behind a paywall? What right. do we not? What do we make people have to subscribe to and receive on MLB.tv? And as a subscriber to MLB.tv, do you deserve exclusive content because you're right, a well-paying right. customer? You know, things like that. So there was a lot of that stuff was literally being figured out on a nightly basis by a lot of the people I was working with at both of those organizations. And I think that helped me shape being in that position and enjoying being in that position of getting people together to, from, you know, companies that we perceive to be direct competitors. They come to our conferences at SVG on a regular basis. Well, panel with ESPN, Fox, Bleacher Report, and, you know, Copa 90, like up there yeah. all together, all like sharing what they're doing. It's a very collaborative industry, even though they are ultimately competing with each other. Being at the center of that kind of idea sharing stuff has been really, really exciting.
Oh, so cool. I could pick your brain for hours probably on these trends. So I want to spend a little bit of time and get as much as I can here on the podcast. One thing I think that, you know, going back years and still a question today is the conundrum of where do we put our video? Do we allow for everyone to just natively consume it, especially, you know, in the last, whatever, 3-4 years when it's all about native video? Or, you know, do we drive them back to our website, to our own platform, so where we can serve a pre-roll, where we can drive, you know, some data capture? Is that still a question? And is there any right or wrong answer with, you know, we should have this kind of video on social natively? We should be driving them back to our site for this kind of traffic. Like where is that heading right now? And kind of how have you seen it evolve in your time, if it has?
Yeah, God, it's such a tough question I think this isn't a cop-out answer, but there's got to be a balance. I mean, you really got to balance it. I mean, we've seen just because you don't know what you're ultimately dealing with on platforms that aren't your own. You know, we've seen how mm-hmm. algorithms on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, all fantastic platforms that you 100% have to be on, but something that's out of your control that can change on a dime makes it really difficult for you to just completely marry yourself to any one of these social media platforms. So I feel like you have to strike a balance at this point. You have to be willing to do a little bit of something on as many of them as you can. But I think your own website and destination is still something that holds a lot of value. Obviously, that's a lot of where if you're not doing direct ad integration within your content, that's where a lot of your advertising might be. Like I said, you got to be on all these platforms, but I think also one thing that's important to do, and I think some brands are relatively good at doing this, is picking a social media platform or two and prioritizing them. It's very difficult, especially, you know, through SVG, I work with a lot of content creators and video production pros who work on the college side.
Yep.
And sure, there are some video departments at like Alabama or Texas A&M at Notre Dame where the staffs are just massive and they've got millions of dollars worth of technology mm-hmm. where they're able to create content on a daily basis. And there's plenty of schools, some of them even in the Power Five, and definitely across the major community, who they are literally one man or one woman video production band, right, and they've got to do everything themselves. They work with, you know, marketing when it comes to social, or maybe a director of IT when it comes to the infrastructure of how they do their live event streaming. But what ultimately comes down to it, if you're at a major event like the Final Four or something, and you're the only video person, it's tempting to want to be everywhere, but if there's a platform or two that your content tends to succeed on, like, kick ass at that, and don't worry so much about being everywhere and everything to everyone, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. How much of the limitations, and this kind of, you know, what you were talking about, especially with the college space, has to do with the operations and, frankly, the hardware, I guess, and the equipment? Like, if I'm... And I know you kind of dive into this quite a bit, you know, with your own work, so I'm interested to hear your thoughts on if I'm on the field, you know, before a game or warm-ups or on the court or whatever it is, I can grab my phone and stream on Periscope or on Facebook really easily, whereas, you know, it might not be quite as easy to tie into a directly owned platform or website unless you have a very robust back end. Is that something that the tech is evolving to allow for such ease, where you have something in your pocket you can pull out and start streaming to an owned platform? Or is that where social media still maintains a pretty good advantage in that space?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt. I mean, I think the one thing that we've seen is that the technology has become not only more cost-effective for the most part, depending on everyone's budgets are different, so everyone will say something's, you know, expensive, something's expensive to someone that's not expensive to someone else. But the technology has become so user-friendly, too, and that's been important in college environments, too, because many of these athletic departments that live stream their own events, or they're covering, you know, a football game day with multiple people scattered around the stadium, you don't have the time and or the resources in order to train all of those students on every piece of equipment you have. Mm-hmm. Especially if that, you know, the days of like sitting down with a manual and learning how to use a production switcher or a replay device or a camera, those are long gone. Someone's got to be able to pick it up and use it relatively intuitively. And you're dealing with a relatively rotating group of talent when you're working a lot with students. They're very, students are very, very tech savvy, and they're great with picking out something, a piece of technology that's very user friendly, and they'll take it, they'll go. The idea of being able to shoot a 1080p image on your phone is mind boggling when you think about how cameras tend to cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars that get used for major television productions. And now you don't need to do that. Like, you can literally just, we do this too. And we've got sponsors of ours that produce some of this really, really high-end technological equipment. And we will interview them with my iPhone. They don't love it, but that is, it's like, hey, look, this is a reality. This is what we're doing. You know, we don't have a ton of money and the image is great. So we're going to create this content the way that's most efficient. Now, the one part of that conversation that I do find very interesting from a social media perspective is, what are the differences in the types of live social and what makes each of them valuable, if you know what I'm saying?
So,
you can go live immediately on your phone, and that's awesome. Or you can have a highly produced, like, studio-like show, like Bleacher Report's coverage of the NFL draft. Mm-hmm. They'll live stream that to Facebook Live and YouTube, and that'll be in a full-fledged studio. It'll look like a newsroom. And now, there's differences between those two. There's advantages to having a highly produced, almost like destination time viewing kind of show, because that's an easier product to monetize and sell and build a viewing habit for someone. Like, if a team is like, hey, we're going to go live at 12:30 every Friday to preview the weekend, that's great. You can sell that. You can market that. You can build something around that and create another source of revenue. But if you're just on the court in the immediate moments after your team has just won a playoff game or a championship or something like that, you have the rights to go live. Boom, just pop that phone on, because in that instance, It's the access that's the value, not necessarily the knowledge or the conversation. It's really just, hey, you could take your fans somewhere that literally they would give maybe their firstborn kid to be on that field for that.
Yeah.
Then you don't really need to worry about like overthinking it, overproducing it. Like pop that phone on and get on Facebook Live or Periscope or Instagram Live, whatever it may be.
It's almost like I think of the produced, the pre-planned stuff. You can almost call that TV, because they obviously the term TV is so changed these days. And the other one might be more video. You know, it's just, it is what it is. It's raw. We don't know what's going to happen. It's in the moment. How much does mobile really come into play? Like, is there a convergence of the more advanced tech, like the HD quality, even being able to splice in some graphics from a remote location, where someone is able to walk around untethered around the field, around the court, and shoot in real time? Is there a convergence there of the tech meeting that mobile, I guess, mindset, or is there still a little bit of evolution to occur?
No, I think you can definitely do that, and that's definitely come a long way. I think that the one thing that people do need to understand is that you do need to, as spontaneous as it sounds, to, you know, go on Facebook Live immediately following a game. There's still a lot of preparation that goes into that. I mean, you'll see people test out, you know, Facebook Lives in a stadium before everyone shows up, and then all of a sudden the stadium is packed, and your team has just won a dramatic game, and everyone's on their phone sharing videos of what they did, and then all of a sudden the bandwidth is gone, and your video quality stinks. We've all been there. It drops, but there's like, if you prepare properly with technologies from companies who work with us, like LiveU or TVU or Comprex, like those bonded cellular solutions really go a long way. And they've got relatively small packs now, where they've developed something that you can literally like clip onto your belt, and you can have that peace of mind knowing, okay, I can go live and I'm not going to have to worry about if I'm going to have enough bandwidth to get on. So I think those are, I mean, anyone who works in social or digital media knows this, is that there's a whole lot of spontaneity and on-the-cuff moments, but there's just an insane level of preparation. You have to prepare for the unexpected, or else you're not going to stand a chance.
Ah, super interesting stuff. Really good conversation here with Brandon Costa, Director of Digital at Sports Video Group. I kind of want to touch on a few more quick topics here, and then we'll have this episode Shareable Stat. But I mean, there's a lot of different places I want to go. I want to hear, you know, what you're seeing in the industry. We think of, I think a lot of the work that SBG does is a lot about the real time, the highlights, the games, the performances. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's such a different, or at least there's a growing part of the industry where it's not just the highlights. It's how can we use Adobe After Effects or Illustrator and really turn it into something more, where there's a bunch of effects being added or augmented or graphics being interlaid. I mean, is there a balance there that needs to be affected? Like video, I think, is more than just what you film on a camera now. It's really, what can we do to make it more quote-unquote engaging, make it stand out in our Instagram story or whatever it is. And so I guess it's just to hear your perspective on where the industry is starting to value the quote unquote, you know, highlights or normal highlights compared to, say, the touched up produced stuff that might include, you know, the basketball lighting on fire because he's on fire, and then kind of where that comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff is kind of fun. I mean, a lot of the stuff the brands that we deal with, you know, where there's this just massive influx of data across every sport now, so there's a need to want to differentiate your highlights, especially if these are highlights that you've monetized in some way, mm-hmm. where maybe you've sold a play of the night or the Papa John's Papa Slam or whatever may be. You got to have something in there that differentiates it. So, I mean, you see Statcast-based highlights being turned out on MLB.com in the mornings on a basis now. On a regular basis, I should say. But then you see, you know, Bleacher Report doing some of the stuff in House of Highlights, I think of what you're alluding to, where you've got like players disappearing on their way to the basket and they're throwing down dunks. That's really like, what is your brand and what is the voice you're trying to have online? And Bleacher and, House of Highlights, those are fun, engaging social media platforms that have the rights to those highlights and can do cool things like that. I mean, that stuff is a load of fun. And honestly, I think you're probably going to see inevitably a lot of the traditional brands that maybe have been a little too rigid to go there. They see how successful these social media platforms are. There's a reason why Turner Sports bought Bleacher Report and made it a big part of their brand. They know that they can either, hey, we need to start doing this ourselves, or hey, we need to invest in someone who knows how to do this, who knows how to engage with the sports fan, that's not the person that's going to sit down and watch an entire night-inning baseball game or be there to watch, you know, the 20th game of a regular season in the NBA. But the younger generation still loves sports, loves highlights, loves that content. So the things that you're kind of seeing from those brands like Bleacher and House of Highlights, I can only imagine that that's going to continue to permeate across even the traditional networks and publishers at this point.
Yeah, and I think a key theme, and we can take this a couple of different directions, is that monetization question. Is we know we have all this video, we're already past the point where we can really put it all behind the paywall. I think there's too much out there for free, and that's the expectation of the internet. It seems, much to the chagrin of newspapers, I'm sure, like you have experience with. I guess is there a paradigm evolution of monetizing video? I think we think of the most traditional way is we're gonna throw in a pre-roll or we're gonna throw in a quote unquote old school commercial. But what are the different ways that you are seeing monetization happening out there? Are paywalls the future? Everyone seems like they have 3 billion subscriptions now, or is it more creative insertion of logos and brands like you might see with your BRs of the world, or is there still a place? Is still these prevailing with a lot of pre-rolls because we don't have any better ideas yet, and that's the clearest path to monetization?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. There's so much going on right now. On one extreme, there's esports brands that are doing super cool integrated branding opportunities with their sponsors. And then it's still not uncommon. It blows my mind how it's still not uncommon where if you're like live streaming a live sporting event and they go to commercial, you might still get that slate that says,
totally,
we'll be right back.
Totally.
And it sits there for a couple minutes. And whenever I see that, it's like, how are we still at this point? But that being said, some of the cool stuff that you are seeing being done is like, the idea of a pre-roll is great, but pre-rolls and certainly mid-roll ads, which me personally, I don't really like at all. They prove to be kind of like a stone wall when I'm watching a video that I'm gone at that point. But if you are talking about integrating logos or even more directly like pieces of your own brand into that content, that's the stuff that goes really well. So if leagues, teams, networks are able to find partners that are willing to do some fun stuff and not take themselves so seriously, they can get really, really cool examples. I mean, I've heard this example used at a lot of the esports shows that I've been going to lately, but I mean, Arby's is a tremendous sponsor of a couple of the esports leagues. I can't recall exactly one which right now. And they had a couple of the esports stars who were playing, one of the shoot 'em up games. I sound like such an old man talking about esports right now. I apologize. They're playing some kind of Call of Duty esque game, and they took the esports stars to the shooting range and had them literally shoot Arby's sandwiches and blow them up. And it was a giant hit. There was like an esports event where afterwards the fans were like chanting Arby's, 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 like in the crowd.
Wow.
Can you imagine that happening at any other sporting event, just like sitting at a Yankees game and everyone's chanting Pepsi, Pepsi? Like you'd never see that. But you have to find the right like partners and brands that are willing to like organically mix into whatever your brand is, whether you're a basketball team or whether you're an esport. Like, hey, this is what we're all about. Our audience is important to you, or else we wouldn't be having this conversation. How can we work more directly instead of you just sending us a 15-second spot that we're going to slap on the front of the video? What can we do? If it's a local restaurant, let us film a segment with a player where we're eating at your restaurant and we're talking about stuff. You know, like Temple Athletics does a really cool series called Cheesesteaks with Coach, and one of their video guys, Kevin Topp, goes around and he interviews players and coaches while they're eating cheesesteaks at various restaurants, and I'm pretty sure he monetizes a couple of those. And those are local brands that want to reach out to the Temple Athletics community, and now that's directly integrated into the content. You're going to see a whole heck of a lot of more of that. It does take a lot more work, let's be honest, but hey, if you want really strong results, you got to be willing to put in that work.
And so much more effective than your old school pre-roll or whatnot. And now all I have in my head I'm just picturing an exploding like beef and cheddar right now. I did want to touch on a couple more quick things before this was a terrible stat here with Brandon Costa of Sports Video Group. I think we all kind of grapple with metrics, with KPIs. And, you know, we look at, I think we always are gravitate to naturally toward the biggest number, which typically is views. And I think the, you know, for us in the industry, we understand that it's a relatively deceptive term when a 3-second view on most platforms counts as a view. And it, you know, while, you know, if you look at the completions or 90% completions, whatever your preference is, it certainly tells a much different and frankly more accurate story, I would say, especially if you're dealing with short form content, even with long form content. So is there any answer to these questions, or is it really just depend on, you know, what the sponsor is looking at and what's going to ultimately tell the best story? Or are you starting to see people kind of own up to the fact that, yeah, those view counts we used to, you know, be so vain about and love to spout off, they're maybe not quite telling the most accurate story?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. I mean, I'll have to speak on the basis of some conversations that I've had with other people and how they more directly deal with that, because we, you know, Sports Video Group is not really driven as an organization by overall views and clicks.
Right, right.
We are very much a, and we mean it, it's not just a line, we are a quality over quantity business. We don't get anything at SVG if we get 3,000 clicks on something if 3,000, if those 3,000 people are not people that work in the industry, you know, like I'd much rather have 50 to 100 clicks on something, knowing that all 50 and 100 of those clicks are coming from people who work high up
in
technology in those companies. So I think that's one of the things that, and I think you can kind of parlay that out for other brands too. I mean, we're definitely progressing. I mean, a lot, I think I get a little defensive because a lot of times those digital numbers get hammered. But in the same breath, it's like, look, Nielsen numbers have never been all that great since the beginning of TV anyway. It's like, that's not exactly a great representative sample of how many, who, and what type of person is watching your content.
Yeah.
You just kind of get a generic number that's extrapolated from a small sample size, and that's really it. So now people are really looking to more directly get to know who is interacting
more
with their
more
content.
More context.
Whether right, exactly. Context behind it, yeah. Because, you know, someone actively coming to your homepage looking to buy tickets is someone who's very different from someone who just happened to see a story of yours go by in their social media feed and they clicked it by accident. You know, it's a, you need 100%. To know, like, where they're going, what they're doing, what their purpose is, if they come back multiple times. And it's the same thing with, you know, with video views, especially with live video. You know, when you got someone tuning into a live sporting event, there's obviously multiple touch points that you can make from that. And whether we see that evolve through some of the new digital media platforms that could potentially start to take over the sports rights business somewhere over the next couple of years. I mean, Amazon is already in there live streaming Thursday night football games. Facebook has exclusive baseball games right now that they're airing once a week. They, you know, who knows if Google or, you know, Netflix swears to the blue in the face that they don't want to get involved in the live sports games, but who knows what they decide, what direction they decide to go after Disney comes out with their version of whatever Netflix is going to be, and suddenly there's a serious, legit competitor to what Netflix does. You know, those are the kinds of companies that are going to do some interesting things like, hey, you know, Aaron Judge just hit a home run, boom, pop-up jersey, pop-up bobblehead, you know, direct interactions. Oh, you know, the Yankees are home in a couple of days, click this and buy tickets.
Right,
like
right.
This. Those are the companies that are going to be more likely to be able to do stuff like that, where you're just going to see your content, especially in a live environment, hopefully become more interactive, especially on the big screen too. That's obviously stuff that you could theoretically already see happening on a mobile device or on a tablet.
100%.
But if you're talking on like a Roku or an Apple TV, that's stuff that you could start to do on the big screen, and then you could have an even bigger segment of your audience interacting with live content that way.
Yeah, it'll be super interesting to see what we see with year two of Thursday Night Football on Amazon and Twitch now as well, with that just begging for interaction and actionable elements. One more quick one for you, if you before we do this little shareable stat. The second screen, and I think just overall, just even megacasts, broadcasts, multiple angles, isolated angles, star cams. I mean, where are we going with the evolution of a broadcast? I mean, you started alluding to it there with smart TVs making it more interactive. Has anyone sort of figured it out? Is it a matter of letting you choose your own commentator or, you know, live chat during it? Or what is the second screen right now, and where do you see it going soon here?
Yeah, I mean, I get a chance to go to a few pretty cool events with SVG to kind of see what everyone's doing behind the scenes. And, you know, the event that is no surprise that the event that probably does that best right now is when ESPN goes to the College Football Championship, and they do their mega cast that just blows it out in all these different kinds of crazy options. And people will hem and haw and make fun of it on social media. But when it comes down to it, it's like, look, most of these are not built for you if you're not interested. They're not building all of these 20 different viewing options expecting you to go watch all 20. You pick the one that you want. If you are a really big fan of the team that's in the game, maybe you want to go watch the Villanova team cast and get your hometown announcers and view your content that way. Or maybe you're not a fan of either team and you really like breaking down basketball and you want to watch a studio full of a couple of, you know, three or four coaches breaking down what's happening throughout the game.
Yeah.
Talking to folks at ESPN, the reason why they love it is like, look, you can try things out with relatively no risk attached to it. It's not like you're saying, hey, we're going to completely change the main game broadcast and not have a play-by-play guy, and we're going to have three coaches breaking down the game instead. You would have mass revolt of people watching that game. But you can make all these new content opportunities available without jeopardizing the quality of the main broadcast right. that, in this case, is on ESPN. So it's a super exciting time right now because, as anyone in digital will say, you just have to try things, break things, fail at things. We're in such a comfortable point right now where you can go out and try stuff. And I think for the most part, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, I tend to give those people and those publishers and those brands that try something different the benefit of the doubt. I love that. Like, I know that there's a lot of people who watch sports who the second you tweak anything, you have no respect for the game and oh my God, this and that. Like earlier this year when, on Thursday Night Football, they decided to go all Skycam.
Yeah.
Sure, you might say, all right, Brady, you work at SVG. Cool. Yeah, of course you want to watch that kind of camera technology stuff. But still, like, I just so loved that they were willing to, like, try that. And, yeah, you're going to probably piss off a bunch of people in the process. But, I can't imagine that we're going to be watching football games exactly the same way 50, 60 years from now. So somebody's going to have to take that risk. And I frankly love it when they take those risks because you love trying new stuff and seeing what sticks. And with the megacast, for example, a couple of things have stuck and a couple of things they've gone, well, that was terrible. Let's not do that again. And then you just kind of learn. And it's a really exciting time. And I think from a second screen perspective, you're going to get a lot more of that. You're going to almost see, I honestly love what Barstool does with some of their stuff where you're just kind of watching their talent watch the game. If you're brand talent is the stars of your organization, then your fans would love to like sit there and watch the game with your people.
Right.
And that's a kind of, you're sitting there, you're watching the game and you got them on your laptop and you're watching the game with your quote unquote friends that you follow along, whether it's the regional sports network talent or it's, you know, the broadcasters that are in the booth, you're sitting there, you know, interacting with them. That's kind of that second screen content that I think is really going a long way because as digital continues to grow, you're going to have digital native personalities, if you will, that are going to have a lot of clout that I think people might even want to listen to over the traditional play-by-play announcer or the color commentator that's on the game.
100%. I guess the answer is there's no right answer. There's no like paradigm that it's all going to be this. It's really everyone's may have their own experience that they the way they want to watch the game, and so we're gonna have thousands of different experiences potentially.
Yeah. I would only say the right answer is don't feel like you have to do the same thing that's always been done. The right answer is if you think you've got a new idea that's interesting, try it. Like just try it.
Oh, so well put. And Brandon, we have so much more we got to talk about, but we'll have a little more fun in our Banter with Brandon segment coming up. But first, steps will shareable stat. We'll be right back with that.
Really enjoy talking to Brandon. I could pick his brain all day. There's so many different angles that he needs to be aware of and so many different ways that video is quickly evolving in the social and digital space in sports. But we'll have more fun with Brandon coming up in our Banter with Brandon segment. But first, this episode's shareable stat. This episode's shareable stat looks at the growth of stories. Saw this recently with Josh Constein of TechCrunch tweeting out about Facebook in particular. And there's a few stats I'll give you here, but they're all very shareable. Don't worry. Is that stories will overtake Facebook feed sharing. So the amount of content going to stories versus the feed. Stories will overtake feed by the year 2019, so next year. Also, stories are growing 15 times faster than feeds, and story creation and viewing since early 2016, so about 2 years ago, is up 842%. And if you're listening to this, you're likely pretty well-versed in stories and how they are growing. It's not just on Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat. It's a new way of looking at content. And you know, whether you are looking to just grow your stories and certainly you know learning a little more about what works, what's going to get someone to complete it, certainly we've heard a lot of experts on this podcast talk about building narratives and using the swipe up as well to drive meaningful and measurable results. But really what it comes down to is looking at what can we learn from the fact that stories are growing so quickly and really taking over all platforms. It's that quick snackable content, the ability to browse a narrative. And this is not just mean that you have to overdo it on Instagram stories and Snapchat or Facebook stories, as it were, mainly just Instagram being shared to Facebook, but it's really how can we use our own platforms even and recreate this story format. You know, I work in the mobile space, so I'm always looking at how our fans engaging on mobile, and right now it's tapping or browsing or swiping to the next thing. They're swiping to the next date on Tinder. They are tapping to the next snap on Snapchat or Instagram stories. They're swiping up to view more on Snapchat and Instagram. It's really an interesting way to see the paradigm shift in any way you can present content that feels that native way that fans are getting accustomed to consuming it, digesting it. It's a powerful thing. So that's this episode's Shareable Stat, all about stories growing 15 times faster than the feed for Facebook. The content and viewing since early 2016 is up 842%, and by next year, you will have more stories being posted to Facebook and Instagram than you will to the feed. So that's this episode's Shareable Stat, certainly one to talk about the water cooler and think about how it may affect your content sharing. All right, we'll be right back to talk more with Brandon Costa of Sports Video Group and get ready for a little banter with Brandon.
Right back from this episode of Shareable Stat, joined once again by Brandon Costa of the Sports Video Group, Director of Digital there. Brandon learned a ton about video from you in your interview. You kicked ass. Are you now ready to do a little banter with Brandon?
Oh, I was born for this. Anything with alliteration and my name in it, sign me up.
Hell yeah. Alliteration, so underutilized. All right. Number one for you, your favorite piece of content that you either shared, posted, worked on when you were at MLB Advanced Media?
Oh, when I was at MLB.com, again, it was, you know, kind of the early days of what's been, you know, what we kind of expect is normal in the digital environment now. But we would always really, really blow out the All-Star game. Obviously, we would go nuts in the playoffs and the World Series as well. But the MLB All-Star game and the Home Run Derby and the Futures game were some of the coolest things that we got to do. So in one of my first months that I was there, literally, I'm still like on the high of like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm working at Major League Baseball right now. I got to kind of host the like 5 to 10 minute like, basically, like it was almost like a traditional Sports Center segment recapping the entire Home Run Derby, but that was the one in Pittsburgh, I believe.
Okay.
I think David Wright won that Home Run Derby. If I can't remember who won it, that's embarrassing, because on one hand, this is like one of my favorite memories of working at MLB.com was that first Home Run Derby that I got to do with them. And again, so such early times that having like a 5 minute clip online of what happened at the Home Run Derby was like relatively cutting edge at the time.
So let me ask you a follow up. The number two, what kind of content is most popular for baseball fans? Was it the monster home run? Was it the sick defensive play? Was it a filthy strikeout? Or was it some wacky, you know, fan dancing in the stands? Like, what did you find that was in highest demand? And what did you prioritize when you were disseminating cutting clips?
It's funny that you mentioned though the wacky person dancing and everything. I think the best answer they can give you for that is like, I find this exciting, but it's also one of the most challenging things about finding success on social, because I'm sure you could talk to anybody who works in social or digital and they'll tell you, I spent days working on this one piece of content. Nobody watched it. I threw up this stupid, idiotic thing that I spent 5 seconds on and it blew up. The best example of this was when we were out at the Olympics. My boss Ken Kirschbaumer and I were out in Pyeongchang for the Olympics, and I was talking with Lindsay Signor. She runs social for NBC Olympics. If you ever get the chance to have her on the show, she's freaking amazing. You should definitely try to talk to her. It was like maybe 7 or 8 days into the games. And at that point, their most popular clip was the shot. I don't know if you remember it. There was the walkie-talkie that was sliding down the ski hill. And there was like some poor guy who worked, who was working on the Olympics. Yeah. Was like barreling down the hill, chasing after this. And this wasn't even something that was on during a live event. It was like literally just the cameras were rolling and they were getting ready to go live an event. And someone looks up and just goes, that's funny. And they clipped it, and it was like far and away their most popular clip. So it's like, as much as we think so hard about highlights and post-game interviews and coaches and player interviews and all that stuff, and all very important because they're kind of the baseline that you need to have, some of the goofiest shit just succeeds on social. It's inspiring and also immensely frustrating at the same time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the artificial tones that might be coming our way with what video works the best, it all goes to crap when you just get that real, authentic, awesome highlight.
right, exactly.
Number three for Brandon, tell me your number one tip for effective social media video. We can take this in any number of directions.
I think this kind of alludes to something I said a little bit earlier. I think that personal accounts have the potential to hold a lot more power than branded accounts, if that makes sense. Now, I mean, obviously you need to have a brand account if you're a team. And there are some teams that do phenomenal jobs with their brand accounts. They have a lot of fun on there. They do some really cool stuff. But I think putting the efforts behind having a quote-unquote digital face for your brand, an individual person that your fans can interact with, someone that's fun, funny, engaging in interviews, acts as an expert on the team, can really go a long way. And I think we've seen a few teams start to do this, where obviously they've got their main brand account, but then there's kind of a fun digital personality who's very smart, knows the team very well, almost like a beat reporter, but a team-based beat reporter. Yeah. I think those kinds of accounts, it's much more natural as a fan to want to interact with a person as opposed to a logo.
No, that's a great point. I've even seen some teams, basically allow their social media manager to be that host almost, and they're going to take you around the arena before the game or whatnot. Definitely seen a growth of in-house beat reporters, as you mentioned. That's an area that I had an early person on the podcast who did it for the Kings, or does it for the Kings currently, and it's been interesting to see that space grow for sure. All right, number four for you, Brandon. Just tell me a fun fact about Hofstra. I haven't met anyone from Hofstra before, so what do I need to know about it?
we're sneakily floating around there somewhere, I think. So Hofstra, geez. All right, here's one. I think this is still true. I would need to go back and verify. It was true when I was there. The founders of Hofstra are this couple from like the 1800s or the 1900s or something, Kate and William Hofstra. And the legend was that Kate was like a big time cat lover. So she was obsessed with animals and she particularly loved cats. So when I was there, you would see outside of like every administrative building on campus, there would be like bowls of food and water, like little bowls of food and water all around the campus. And the story was that every administrative office, again, I'm horribly speculating here because I don't know if it's true. This is literally just hearsay. I know for a fact that she liked cats, but I don't know if they had to do this. But the story was that if the administrative offices would have to leave bowls out every morning for stray cats that might be loose on the campus. Then we would have just kind of like stray cats, not a lot of them, but there you would see like two or three cats on your walk to campus. And the story was that that's something that people who work at Hofstra still have to do as kind of a nod to Kate Hofstra.
Oh, that is incredible. I had no idea how you were going to answer that question, but that blew past any expectations I had. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and see if they're still doing that, but when I was there, you would literally walk by and you'd see bowls of catnip and water just like everywhere.
Oh, that's incredible. All right, number five for you, Brandon. Tell me the best sports game that you've ever attended, whether it was for work or as a fan.
Oh, I guess I would have to say it was probably this year's Super Bowl. So that was through work. It was my first Super Bowl, so that was immediately, by default, an awesome experience. Oh, but the game ended up being awesome, really delivering. I had zero rooting interest in the game, but it was so weird being there because it's like being at an event where you know And there's few events like this in the world where literally more than 100 million people, like millions of people from around the world are all watching this same thing that you're standing. Wasn't involved in it at all. Was just there covering the behind the scenes and interviewing the people from NBC. But that was spectacular. And I had heard from my boss, who had been to a few Super Bowls before, that the Super Bowl can tend to be a bit of a sterile corporate environment because the tickets are so expensive and there's a lot of people who just go to the Super Bowl without a rooting interest. Let me tell you, not this game, because the Eagles fans freaking took that place over. It was rocking in there when they won the championship. But I guess the last one, I also got a chance when we were at the Olympics in South Korea. I got to go to the U.S.-Russia men's hockey game.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, that it's funny because the game wasn't at all good. We got our butts kicked. And Russia had that kind of sterile name of OAR. They were just Olympic athletes of Russia. So it wasn't purely USA versus Russia, and it wasn't like a great win or anything. But I'm such a big fan of the history of the Miracle on Ice, like a lot of people are. So to kind of be there at a game that's kind of in the lineage of the history of that quote-unquote rivalry, I got a little emotional when I was sitting there in the stands when that puck dropped. I got a lot. And I got a lot.
Very, very cool. Yeah, both those sound like incredible events to have attended. I would love to go to Super Bowl myself one day. That's on my bucket list, so you got to take me with you next time. All right.
Yeah, I'll give it a good day.
Number six for you. I want to know your favorite team and your favorite athlete growing up. Who was in your childhood?
I mean, I was a really big Yankees fan when I was a kid. I mean, it helped that they were really good as I was growing up. I mean, they stunk when I first started watching them in, like, the Don Mattingly days, but then they got really good. I'm a Jets fan, so that is still a terrible existence, but I love them anyway. But I'd have to say my favorite team is the New Jersey Devils, and my favorite athlete growing up was probably Martin Brodeur. It's funny, when you work in sports, you can lose a little bit of that edge to your fandom. I'm sure even you experience this, where, you know, you see so much of how the sausage gets made and you realize it's a business, and you just kind of naturally grow up. Still love sports, but you're not as, like, diehard as you used to be. But I still will always, to this day, love throwing on a very ill-fitting Martin Brodeur jersey and going to see the Devils.
Oh, that's awesome. Now you just got to, paint your chest like Putty does.
Exactly. He was at one of our playoff games this year.
That was fantastic. I loved seeing that. That was so great, especially me as I'm a diehard Seinfeld fan as well. All right. I want to know the advice you'd give an aspiring sports media pro. There's any different ways you can go with it, but what would you tell someone who says, I want to work in sports media?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, there's so many ways that you could go with it. What I would say is, I guess to keep it relatively simple, because we could go down a few rabbit holes about, you know, work-life balance and all that kind of stuff. But I would say when you're early in your career, there can be a lot of pressure to network, which is obviously very important. And in this day and age, you will likely hop around to a few different jobs relatively quickly early on in your career. At least that was my experience, and I feel like that's the experience of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think it can be tempting when you're in that point of your career and you're ready for a new challenge to let the search for a new gig kind of overcome you. And really, when you are looking to make that next leap, be it to another company or, you know, to a higher position or whatever it may be, the best thing that you can do is do your current job absolutely as best as possible. You get noticed by doing what you do right now really well. You're not going to get anywhere by having one foot half in the door while you're busy searching for another gig. People in this industry will notice if you're doing a good job. So even if you are like, oh man, I'm kind of over this job, I really want to do something different, do that job as best as you possibly can, because that is the best resume item that you could put out for somebody.
Very nice. No, I love hearing that for sure. The best food, if I'm out in New York City, which is where SBG is based, the best food to get out there?
Geez, I mean, that's like an almost impossible question, I got to be honest. It's New York. I mean, I could go a million directions. So because that's so difficult, I think I'm just going to go punt on New York, and I'm going to tell people to not be discouraged from taking the path over to New Jersey, because I love New Jersey to death. Mm-hmm. Go to downtown Jersey City. I used to live there. Absolutely loved it there. There's a Mexican restaurant called Taqueria Downtown. It's very no frills. You can get like a taco for like $2. Get like two or three of them. Get a margarita there. The stuff is top notch. And then you can hang out in downtown Jersey City where there's a lot of cool bars and everything. And I'll tell you, you take the path, it's not that long. You can get from Midtown Manhattan to downtown Jersey City in like 20, 25 minutes, which is a shorter trip than it is to go up to Yankee Stadium. So I'm telling you, don't be afraid, New Jersey. Get over there. There's a lot of really cool stuff in both Hoboken and downtown Jersey City.
All right. Did not see that coming at all. All right. Last one for you before you get to share your social media also to follow. Tell me your favorite team to follow on social media.
This is interesting because I tend to follow more of influencers than teams. Obviously, I like what the teams do. I mean, yeah. I'll give you two because I feel like the first one is a no-brainer. I mean, I follow Jess Smith over at the Yankees, like, religiously. I think she does a phenomenal job. And I'm also really like the work. Speaking from one trade association to another, I guess. I don't know if they would deem themselves to be a trade association or not. But I really think that the guys over at Front Office Sports are doing an absolutely bang-up job right now. I mean, they've grown that thing relatively quickly. They develop really useful and helpful content. And there really has been kind of a hole in the industry for, networking and professional development for the younger generation that's come up. I mean, you know, even us, like, we're focused on, our core membership is the people who are already established SVPs and VPs and all that kind of stuff. SBJ tends to direct a lot more of their content to people that are, you know, the legit people who are at the top of the field. But Front Office Sports, Adam White, I got the chance to meet him at a variety event out in LA a few years ago, and he was still at Miami at the time, and he's done a fantastic job with it. He's put a really good team together. So if you're not following them already, I don't know what you're doing, but definitely check out Front Office Sports.
Very cool, for sure. So last thing then, before we get you out of here, tell us, where can we find you and Sports Video Group on digital and social?
Sure, yeah. We do a lot of our stuff brand-wise on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can find us on Twitter at Sports Video. You can find us on Facebook at Sports Video Group. LinkedIn, we've got both a company page and also a conversation page where people can share various technology conversations or gear that they tried or trends in the industry. We have a lot of good banter going on in there. And then me personally, you can follow me on Twitter at @SVG_Brandon.
Love it. Well, Brandon, I can't thank you enough for the time today. Just learned so much from you. This space is ever evolving, changing from day to day, hour to hour even. And
everything we just talked about will be pointless by the time you're
seriously. I hope people listen to this right away. But yeah, thanks again for the time, Brandon. And I look forward to definitely connecting with you in person someday soon as well.
Yeah, Neil, keep up the great job, man. Really appreciate you having me on this. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much again to Brandon Costa, Director of Digital for Sports Video Group. They do a lot of good stuff over there. Following him and following SVG, it will really give you a lot of good insight into how, not just what the trends are in video, but also how they're making it happen. You know, the tech behind it, the operations behind it, and there's so much more to it, especially when you're operating in the very fast-paced world of sports and social. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for downloading and listening. I am your trusty host, Neil Horowitz. You can find me on Twitter at NJH287. Hit me up on LinkedIn as well and check out the website at dsmsports.net. And, of course, you can always subscribe and get more episodes of the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Mixlr, and really a lot of places out there. So that'll do it. Until next time, this is Neil Horowitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.